do want to engage with you in a discussion. And the frame of it is meditation. And so maybe I would like to know from you, what does it bring, what brings you here in the first place to meditation? And maybe we can do that offline as well. For you to go just around and say one sentence of what brings you to meditation. What do you think meditation does for you in your life? What is it? To learn about the mystery?
Or just kind of, it's the quickest way, it's the thing I understand least, kind of, you know, or something that I don't have any answers for, sort of. Uh-huh.
No comment? No, maybe...
Now, since I'm doing it for 10 years, I confess it, there's still quite a lot of pain and struggle in my life. And part of me is like, what's going on? You know, what am I doing? Like, I feel thrown into wanting to look more closely. What am I doing? Because here's my wish. And you mentioned your wish of, you know, recollection or harmony. And here's my effort of sitting still. So how does this go together? And and another context of our discussion is a sentence I stumbled over, or a koan I stumbled over just recently from the sutra that's said to be the sutra that first came when Buddha Shakyamuni was sitting under the Bodhi tree. It's like his first vision, the first minute of his vision of his awakening. And in that sutra, Avatamsaka Sutra, it says, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones. But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So the Buddha, so we got this Buddha, a wise person, a person who has a clear vision, is saying, I now see all sentient beings everywhere fully possess the wisdom and virtues of the enlightened ones. But because of false conceptions and attachments, they do not realize it. So when we talk about meditation, you know, the context now is of our discussion, we have a wish, we want to come to a place. There's a causal link that we experience of engaging in meditation or in other practices that get us something, some calm or some harmony or recollection, you know. And that's a causal link, but there's also the causal link of, well, you already have it, it's already here, so we don't have to do anything about it, actually, but there is attachment and false conceptions. So if you're doing anything, any causal link we're doing, we're dealing with false conceptions and attachments. So I don't know, are we on the same page here of we're here at home and we're doing activities that help us bring closer to home. Of, for example, sitting quietly for 2 hours. So how do we know? So how do you know that we are attached and with false conception? How do you know when we are in a place of, you know, our fulfillment of our recollection, of our calm, of being home, that we got there where we wanted to go. So there are two ways of knowing that are called in Buddhism. One is called intuitive knowing. So in one sense, we like get up before meditation and say, that was a good meditation because I feel more recollected, or I feel more calm, or I feel at home, I feel more harmony, so I got what I wanted. So there's an intuitive knowing, or there's a logical knowing of like, I was really agitated before I sat down, now I feel calm, so therefore the sitting period helped me in getting what I want, that calm. So So there are two ways of how we know that we come to a place. And I also want to, and we're just emphasizing this causal link, and I'm not sure if you're seeing that. You can interrupt me anytime, ask a question anytime, please. Because it's kind of like a sportsman. For example, somebody said liberation or harmony. So if you're a person who is a sports person and you want to participate in the Olympic Games, then there's a certain, first of all, confidence you have to have in yourself, that you, in your own skills, that you can participate in the Olympic Games, that you have a trainer and a training that will guide you to participation, and that the Olympic Games are good things to participate in. Otherwise, the whole force and the whole energy doesn't come along with participating in this event. So for this event to happen, a lot of confidence and trust has to be engaged, and you have to have certain conditions to come up. So if you are interested in whatever you're interested in your meditation, the higher you set your goal, the more effort you're putting out there in order to reach it, right? So if you say, well, I don't know, you know, there's like, there could be a little bit of a drawback there of like, well, do we have a place to go, or maybe not? Well, then, you know, I mean, there's like the little dance here that can happen, because faith is a big ingredient in our engagement of any activity we are doing. And we're obviously doing an activity, we're not doing anything. We're doing the activity of sitting down, you know, maybe following the breath or feeling the body, or having a thought, having a mantra. So how do we, this actual activity during this meditation period, how do we engage in it in a way that we first of all come to the outcome of whatever outcome we have, be it participating in the Olympic Games of meditators or whatever, or coming home, or being calm, or not knowing, you know. Maybe you want to come to a place of, you know, I want to come to this place of ultimately not knowing. I heard about it in the teachings, and how is that? So how do we know, again, how we get there? So intuitively or logically? Mostly in the teaching, there's, of course, the logical way is being discussed, because that's the way we talk, and that's probably the way we're going to have a conversation. It's like, well, my experience is like this, and I did this, and I heard this. And because if you go on the more intuitive level, you can be, you right and wrong doesn't touch it anymore, right? And yet we always get told that on the wisdom of the enlightened ones is not a wisdom of right and wrong. So it's kind of a surf here, and that's why I'm really wanting to know your discussion and your input too. So the teachings also say there are five ways we can, where we receive our knowledge from. So we receive it either through direct seeing, for example, right now we see that I'm talking and you're quiet. And so therefore this must be a Dharma talk. Or we see we're sitting in a small sendo, and therefore we can infer, that's like a valid inference, that maybe somebody else is in the big sendo. So we know these two ways. We know directly it must be a Sunday and a Dharma talk time. And so that's a direct knowing of something, or we can infer that there's a group in the sendo. So this is a second way of how we can know things. The fourth way is either through scriptures, like I noticed you got very quiet after I said Sabhatam Saka Sutra, so there's a certain impact of, wow, there's a scripture and it beholds something and it knows something. So we can know through scripture, and we can know through an authentic teacher, like a person who embodies the truth, or embodies true wisdom. So these are the four sources of where we know things. And again, why I'm talking about this, why I want this conversation, to the Matrix thing was struck me. I recently heard this story of, like, I don't know how it was for you when you were a child, but when you were a child and you had the thought that there was a monster in the room and you had to go to bed, then it was either your mom telling you, like, no, there's no monster in the room and please go. So it would be like the authoritative person if you believe that person, you know, so strongly. And you might be able, you know, she might be with you till you fall asleep. And that would be one way of, you know, overcoming the dangerous situation of there being a monster in the room. Or you were like really so agitated about this monster in the room, your mom telling you, you know, there's no monster room didn't work. You were still like really engaged with that thought. Had a strong attachment and strong false conceptions. And therefore, she actually had to like turn on the light and go with you through the room and look under the bed and look in the closet and look everywhere to see, well, is there a monster in the room or not? So there was a certain analysis that was necessary for you to find out, some logical thinking and some direct seeing that were like, okay, now actually I am safe, I can go to bed. So, in the same way, like, you can transfer the monster being the self or the source of all suffering, you know, being proposed being the self, or the monster could be, you know, where does disharmony come from, where does agitation come from in your life, you know, if you want the opposite. So you go look for it. Where is it? What makes it? What is it actually that creates it? Because again, there's a causal link here, right? So if that's something that's not there, for example, sometimes, and I don't know if you had the experience, sometimes you're really upset about something and there's a certain emotional reaction just going its course, and if you calm down and sit down and you look back, the situation wasn't actually that threatening, or you go to a person and you think a person hates you. You ask the person, are you really hating me? Like, no, I just had a miserable day or something. You know, like sometimes if we investigate into the causes of what our feelings and perceptions are, that disperse. So there's a certain investigation and analysis that's helping us. So me talking about it in this lecture is mostly based on us being here in a school where we constantly hear, well, just sit facing the wall and that will be fine. And I would like to propose today and have a discussion with you about, well, what about analysis? What about actually sitting down and think actively and look actively, for example, about if we have a self or not. That would be like one proposed topic to meditate about and actively think about and look about. I would like to hear from you already some thoughts and questions that come up for you at this point.
What's a saffron? What's a saffron word? What does that mean?
Self?
That word.
So self?
Oh, is that what you said? The self? I'm having trouble
self.
With it. The self.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying, okay, could you go back and mm-hmm. say that one more time?
Then? Sure. So if you know what I was saying with a kid that's like afraid about the monster in the room, that's kind of the analogy traditionally of like saying if there's a self, we believe I'm a self.
Okay.
Right? I'm talking to you.
Right.
And I want you to understand me.
Right.
And so myself can be threatened by, oh, my fast speech and my German accent gets in the way, right? And I could get tired about it.
Right, right, okay.
And so I can cling about this self or this, you know, get uptight about like, oh no, I'm again, this person who is, you know, not being understood by other people, you know. So there's a certain suffering that can come along by believing in me being...
So the monster is the self, is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
I go, this belief into, there's an identity here that's always talking too fast and with a German accent and nobody understands.
Okay, yeah. I understand now.
Yeah, who so if character? I can be a little bit relaxed with this idea, even though the conditions are obviously there, you know, for it to be that way, but if I could relax with it, then I could still at least try and engage with you in a way that would be maybe not too fast speaking and a little bit more clear speaking.
Yes.
And then...
Then the self would be no problem.
Yeah, it wouldn't be.
Okay.
And it would be a different self,
too. Right. Okay.
It occurred to me that this famous saying by Dogen, to study the Buddhist way is to study the self, the progression is a kind of analysis or a kind of logic, in a sense. Like, in order to begin this practice, you actually have to meet yourself or study or come to terms with what self is. And then through that process there's release and then unification with all things. So there's an actual kind of what you might call a logical progression, or and you could even say it's analytical. That's very interesting. I didn't think about it until you brought this up.
And I didn't think about it till you brought this up about this beach, that itself is like, I keep thinking about self being like this entity, and if I just once realize this entity being not inherently there, then everything will be relieved. And I heard that proposal also theoretically, but it must be a big bang somewhere on the road. And before that, there might be just like small aha of like, well, I'm changing right now, so therefore, who am I? You know, just like small little investigation courses. And maybe even after that big bang, there will be more thoughts about, well, who is this right now? So it's actually not a static thing, it's more dynamic.
Big bang, like on the highway, you said?
No, big bang were like you see clearly...
Cosmic.
You mean the light, light bulb over the head?
No, it isn't. Traditionally, they're saying, so here's a teaching, right? So this is analyzing and investigation. That on one point of our, we are studying, watching the self from moment to moment. On one point, you see clearly that there is nothing that holds this body, the feelings, my seeing or my thinking, my being aware, nothing holds that together. It's just a wonderful occurring of it right now and right now and right now, and maybe not the next moment anymore, right? But there's a certain magic there that keeps these elements from coming together. And the Big Bang would be to be like, clearly see that and nothing averts that anymore. But you see that sometimes, right? Sometimes we saw that, otherwise, you know, I mean, we did have seen it. Right, Rob? Yeah.
And sometimes little.
Yeah.
If not analytical themselves, be confirmed.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I want to go back to the of yourself. Telling you this.
Right. However, there's one link in there that I like to emphasize, which is love. For example, like with our parents, you know, for me to have had my mom be like training me over and over, okay, let's go around, there's no monster here, no monster here, no monster here. That, and the way she did it, you know, without judgment, you know, without being too authoritative, but giving me the time to find out till I really calmed down and really saw it myself. So the love from her or from my dad or whatever so the love from our teacher over that time, then when we're alone, is still there too. Like, then I'm alone at home, my parents are not there, I'm really agitated about a monster. I remember my parents loving me, and that love will carry forward and gives me the strength to that action. So the same in our teaching realm, we practice this love to our teachers because they are loving us, they're giving us all this patience, you know, and doing all our stupidity. And so we're giving this love to them, and that love then will help us when we are on the road by ourselves, you know, in the form of either meeting our own death or, you know, being in meditation or difficult crisis. We remember how we have been loved, and love itself helps us to go through with the difficult task of, okay, I could look over the monster if it's there or not, you know.
So the end goal is independence from the teacher, not dependence on the teacher.
It is still independence, but it's an independence that's carried, you know, and it's not.
It sounds like you kind of internalize the teacher, is what you're saying. Like, the dependence is still there, and that teachings, like the power of what the teacher has imparted to you, is still there and still has value, but it's no longer, that person doesn't need to be in the room with you, it doesn't need to be there.
Right. Person doesn't need to be in the room, and also he kind of is with you in the room, or she is with
you
in the room.
From you.
Through the love,
yeah, okay.
To what you got through the love.
And you're saying you're never really alone?
Kind of. Like, our parents are still with us, you know? I mean, there's always some, you know... I mean, there's so much came forward to make us. You know, here we were a baby, you know, here we were growing up. So many things came forward to make us. That love is still with us. If it were, like, direct parents, or if we didn't have any parents, or the parents weren't that loving to us, there were still other conditions that very much, you know... made us. We got food, you know, we got clothing, we got people who looked at us, even though if our parents didn't. So there was always some forces of love coming to us all the time. Like Cheryl said, gratitude, you know, there's always something to be grateful for. And that in itself is kind of the underlying...
It was like we're all connected in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You always surprise me somehow or another. When we talk, or when I hear you talk, and I'm surprised because I hear you saying that when we sit on the cushion, we should think.
Yes. And actually, I do have a meditation. I don't know what time it is for us to explore that way of how we might want to do that, thinking on the cushion. Because I would say I'm one of these people who is highly thinking, right, and I use that thinking most of the time to whatever process things. And so looking back, I could see, oh yeah, it was necessary, and to some part it wasn't skillful enough to really also come to an outcome. You know, there can be thinking that doesn't lead anywhere, you know. It's not. It's like a dull knife, and you keep like cutting.
Mm.
You know, it's like a dull knife. You don't do anything with it. You know, dull scissors. So, how to sharpen the knife in a way that you can cut paper and make nice art and whatever.
So, when we were going around originally, the first thought that came to my mind is. I come here for Sangha, and I wonder if, I've been thinking a lot lately about thinking, and it seems to me as I get older that it's best done in a dialogue, or in community, in Sangha, and that internal dialogue on the cushion seems to me less constructive. Certainly less interesting. Because it's not as surprising as the dialogues when you have this creativity of conversation going on.
Mm.
Where you don't know what's going to happen.
When you talk with somebody else.
You have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
if we're in this dialogue now, we're creating something together and we don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
Mm-hmm. But we'll discover something in that uh-huh. in that process that I don't think I could possibly discover sitting on the cushion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's all part of a whole. What came to my mind when hearing Shoho is that the Dalai Lama said, in answer to a question about practice, that he thinks 5 minutes a day of analytic meditation is extremely helpful. And Mark had pointed out to me that in the Tibetan tradition, the monks will first memorize a number of texts
mm-hmm.
and then internalize them and then go into debate once they've really,
mm-hmm.
Well, had their own internal processing. And so I see the, I hear what Shoho is suggesting as a part of the whole piece where
mm-hmm.
there's that internal analysis, and then you move to what Mark is saying about the dialogue
mm-hmm.
as a further way to deepen understanding. But there's also a part where there has to be that shamatha time on the cushion
yes.
too. So it's all they're all a piece of it.
I'm just tired of hearing myself think. you're younger than I am, so when you get to be my age, you might be tired of hearing yourself.
No, I hear myself. I'm tired of hearing myself. I confess. And though some part of me sees that more, maybe I'm not tired of myself too much, that's maybe the huge difference, that some part of me is like, still, thank you for cooking too. To like wanting to use this thinking process that I'm doing in a way that I'm having fun with it. You know, because the thoughts don't stop, you heard that, right? They only stop when we sleep, if you're in coma, you know, or when you know. So the thoughts will always go on. So and if they go on all the time, how can I think in a way? How can this mind be trained to think in a way that's not only having fun, but also helps me guide to a place where I want to be, right? What guides me to the place that I ultimately want to know about life, you know? How can I use it as a tool to meet everything that's appearing in my life as a way to go deeper? So thinking is a tool, and let's use it. And I very much agree with what Mary says about the three elements of talking together, talking about ourselves, and shamatha.
Mary's tired of hearing me think too.
We even hear you think.
It's interesting what Mark was saying, because I'm unable not to think, you know, it sounds like most people are when meditating. But I kind of have that sense of the other, like, in the dialogue that you're describing is lacking, sort of. And because, like, I kind of like to imagine myself as, like, one of my friends, sort of. Like, I like myself, but I only care, I mean, I'm kind of interested in what I'm saying, I kind of understand what I'm saying. So there's, like, kind of very much, like, I don't regard my mind as one entity. It's, like, millions of entities. Millions of people talking, kind of, you know, and jabbering nonsense at each other, kind of, so. But the other question I had, though, too, is one of the things I find interesting and kind of mystifying about Zen tradition is the whole idea of not thinking, the whole idea of like, clearing your mind. But it's not clearing your mind. That's not a good word for it, but it's not. But it's like, but yet you hear that all the time, that, you know, don't think, something like that. So then, what does that really mean? Is that even a goal that's achievable? And what does that mean to someone who's been doing it for a long time?
My response right now is in the context of what Michael was pointing out earlier, this seeing clearly about oneself coming together as different parts. You can look at everything in this universe as coming together out of different parts, and so you can watch your own thinking as coming together out of different parts, and out of that seeing the emptiness of your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So and thinking is just a object, a phenomenon of this universe, and so to see every object coming together as something and not being drawn into it as being substantially real or substantially an own thing in and of itself. It's not. It's made out of parts, it's made out of, like, you know, you have the thing in the sheens, after the sheens, you can find out, if you ask your neighbor what they were thinking and going through, it's probably mostly close to what were you going through, you know, just like the space of your sharing, you know, I mean, there's a certain magic going on of, like, sharing energies and space together, creating oneself, you know. I don't know why.
Just thinking about this question about your own conversation being more boring.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like how I understand you're talking about this analysis is you're not actually making it up yourself. That actually you're getting it from someone else, either
mm-hmm.
relief or reading or something. So in that way, it is like a dialogue with someone else.
It's true.
And in fact, that is what keeps it really interesting, because often the analysis goes against our usual habitual.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I look at the habitual, and sort of that is like a term that Mike used a couple weeks ago about momentum.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain things that just have like a lot of momentum to them, and if you sit with it, sometimes the momentum goes away and it just drops, and other times it just sort of builds and builds and builds and creates more momentum.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of interesting to observe that sometimes, and every day can be different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was going to say that I guess to me it's like there's two ways. You know, one, if you focus on something in specific, like your breath or a mantra or something, then as a way of sort of clearing out all other thoughts because of your focus.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way is kind of like what Jennifer just mentioned. Well, if you just kind of go with the thoughts, eventually they just sort of settle. It's
mm-hmm.
like you can only go so far with it. Even if it builds to a certain point, it reaches a climax, and then it goes the other direction, and eventually it does settle. It's just a longer process.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we're so used to getting things quickly that when we go with the thoughts and we see that they're not settling quickly, we get discouraged and think,
mm-hmm.
well, it'll never settle, and we just kind of get discouraged. But even that type of meditation, eventually the thoughts do settle and dissipate, and eventually kind of go away. So, but it's just a very long process. So most people prefer the other choice, where you focus on something specific,
mm-hmm.
and therefore there's no room for other thinking.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I found also these two, a way of analytical meditation, and it's just because I'm a baby and I don't know much about analytical meditation, but these two I found in my research, of like one being you have a topic and you think about the topic actively. For example, I certainly shall die. So the one's own death, and one can go with and actively create many, many images about death, about our own death, about all the people who we already know died, and to have that as a meditation. So that's like one way to engage one's thinking. The other way is to like really sit quietly, do shamatha first, and then have a sentence and let that sentence over and over be repeated, and then watch if something comes up. You don't make it come up, it just comes up by just sitting quietly, listening to the sentence. And so I was hoping to try this last one out, since we talked about it, to just do one and then see how it feels, and then you can make your own opinion about it.
Mm-hmm.
What about that? I don't know if you have time. Maybe like short. Yeah. Okay, very short. Are you up for it?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay. So let's do 7 cleansing breath. So you pull up your, with the inhalation, you pull up your hand into a fist, and then with the out breath, you kind of go like this. By a short shamatha period of just letting thoughts pass by, and then I will say a sentence repeatedly, and you listen to it and just see what's happening. Within, totally pure awakened mind, there is not the slightest sense of anything to look at or anyone looking. Within the pure awakened mind, there is not the slightest sense of anything to look at or anyone looking. Within totally pure awakened mind, there is not the slightest sense of anything to look at or anyone looking. Not the slightest sense of anything to look at. Not the slightest sense of anything or anyone looking. Within the essence of pure awakened mind, there is not the slightest sense of anything to look at. Can you describe it or catch it as a color or a shape or words? What form can you put to it?
Kind of imagine it as like kind of like following that metaphor of the monster in the closet, but not necessarily a monster in the closet, because I'm not really worried about what's in the closet. I'm just like interested in what's in the closet. It's more of a thing of curiosity. But it's like right before you your hand gets to the doorknob to turn it and look, open the door inside, it's that moment. It's kind of the moment that is kind of like the feeling of the thought, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of had like specific questions kind of I was thinking about.
A question came up.
Mm-hmm.
Great. So that could be like, again, and to capture a question like that and then take that into another period where you sit down and do the same thing just with a question.
Yeah. So that was also a question for you, actually. But maybe afterwards.
Afterwards, yeah. Just a brief sharing before we go to lunch. Mm-hmm.
My mind was a flood, and I was thinking of those thoughts, and I thought, this is death.
That became, was the association?
Yeah. And I went, okay, nothing to see, nothing to look at.
Uh-huh.
And if there isn't nothing to see and there's nothing to look at, then it's nothing like death.
Mm. And what feelings came up with you?
Well, actually, it caught a sickening, numbing, yucky feeling.
Oh.
Just very, very brief.
But you can also put it in a question of, like, take that feeling,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then hold it with a question, what is death?
What is death? Oh, boy.
And see what comes up then.
Oh, okay. All right. That's it. Okay.
And honor that feeling. It's part of it, right? So that's
right.
Your current association with death is a sickening death.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's your current understanding. So now the wish of wanting to really understand what death is,
mm-hmm.
if that's what death is, you know, you come tell us, you know, because we want to know. But maybe something else comes up too.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't thought of that, because I'm just like, okay, this is an interesting experience. Hmm.
Yeah, we want to, like, yeah. Right, how to keep going and go deeper.
Go deeper with that, yeah. Okay. Then he suggested colors, and I started seeing colors, and I said, no, that's a suggestion by the teacher. I could tell that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, like, obviously, and if one does it to oneself, there is this stimulation coming up, and the question is, how much can we trust what's coming up?
Oh, yeah.
As being just what's coming up. If that's what it is, you know, if you start getting into there of, like, no, that's not the answer, no, that shouldn't be it, you know, then we kind of get into...
Oh, yeah, I was having a little debate back and forth of what was, you know...
So it's kind of an intense thing rather than just being relaxed, open.
It was like, what the heck? But it was okay. I was relaxed enough to, you know, deal with what's coming. But it's like I can tell the difference between kind of what comes up and then sort of what my mind is coming up with.
Yeah.
Like they're two separate things. Mm-hmm. The death part was like, oh, okay, here, that. Mm-hmm. The colors, I know where this is coming from. This is because I just heard, she said, whatever colors you've seen. And then I saw red, and then I saw blue. And
yeah.
So there was two different thought processes. Mm-hmm. That.
Well, you're my hero anyway, if you can face a death that's totally sickening. Yeah. I mean, that's pretty strong, courageous.
What?
That's pretty courageous. Other sharings? In fact, there is a beautiful, also again, visual analytical meditation of facing one's monster, like actively calling them up and really visualizing them and then asking them, what do you want from me? You know, how do you feel when you get what you want? And then visualizing again, giving it to the monster, and then the most...
Mara.
Yeah.
Mara. The whole thing with the Buddha.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And the interesting stories of all these stories is once a monster got what it wanted, or it knew it couldn't get what it wanted, it mostly vanished.
It's a monster.
Right.
Yeah. I think we're ready for lunch. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Dedicate the merit of this talk and this discussion to the benefit of all beings. Thank you for participation.